Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you candy. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you an apple and a plum and an apricot or two. Hey.
Welcome to Food for Thought. Join us for a thought-provoking glimpse into the world of the food that we savor. Meet the women and men who are growing it, foraging for it, raising it, cooking it, and who share it with the rest of us. Today's guest is Adam Cantor. Adam is the botanist and consulting biologist of the Table Bluff Natural Resources Department. And we're going to talk a little bit about your relationship with Kat Anderson. Kat wrote the book Tending the Wild, which for me was a real paradigm shift about how we look at how Indian people interacted with the land that they lived on. I mean, I think I grew up with that idea that there was such bounty here in the country and people, you know, just went through and took what they wanted and needed, and food was pretty plentiful, but it wasn't an accident that the land was like that.
That's right, exactly right. Thanks for having me again, Jennifer. Yeah, all the indigenous people, Nancy Turner coined the term, they were complex cultivators. You know, we might look at the vegetation on the landscape as we're driving down the highway and see an oak woodland and a beautiful prairie and just think that, well, that's a product of geology and the last ice age or whatever it might be. But in reality, a lot of the vegetation communities that we see and where we see them are a legacy of Native American caretaking, burning, you know, all different types of kind of pre-agriculture.
Yeah. I've heard that in some cases they have documented that people actually dug up plants and moved them closer to their homes.
Yes, I've read that. I have not read that specifically about the Yurok or the Wiat, but Nancy Turner, who's an ethnobotanist up in British Columbia, has documented that with coastal British Columbian tribes, especially with huckleberry and whatnot. And we do know that the Wiat, you know, burned on a regular basis for berry production as up to every 3 years, and some hazel patches were burned on an annual basis. So there was active management going on.
And how did the geophytes do with that? Those Indian potatoes or those different sorts of bulbs that they ate, how did they do with the fire?
They tend to do well, and some even have been shown to require fire to increase their germination. I can't speak to any of the local species specifically regarding fire, but, you know, fire certainly benefited them just from, you know, keeping out encroaching shrubs and forest, which is, you know, one of the issues at one of the relic gardens out at Malheur Dunes today.
I'm wondering, have you eaten Indian potatoes?
Yes, I've never eaten camas, but I've eaten a lot of the wild onions or alliums, and I've tried brodea once, and they're really good. They're more, I guess, buttery. Their texture is different than potatoes, but, you know, similar.
I was wondering because you showed me, at one point, you showed me what one of the little bulbs look like, and they're tiny. This is not a potato like you're thinking a potato from the Andes. This is like teeny tiny little, if you've ever gardened, a little corm that you might plant in your garden.
Yeah, they can be about the size of a marble. The camas bulbs may be a little bit bigger. So, you know, it was a big effort, you know, to get a lot for a meal, but they could be stored for later use. And, you know, just shows the extent that these used to dominate the landscape. There was a couple of Wiat place names that were named after Indian potatoes. So we know they were much more common on the landscape before the tribes were taken off the land.
Yeah. There was a lot of cultivation involved with those. When they were dug, the soil was aerated. When they were taken out, the bulblets were allowed and made to fall back into the area so that you make sure that you have a crop again the next year.
Yeah, bulbs were scattered, and, you know, generally, you know, harvest practices benefited the populations. You know, one difference between Indian potatoes and regular potatoes is the cooking time. Some potatoes, like camas, would need to be cooked for over 24 hours.
Wow. That's a commitment.
It is. And, you know, a lot of early pioneers, you know, had stories of getting sick. Lewis and Clark got, you know, really sick from eating camas that was thought to have been undercooked. But it's not fast food.
Uh-huh.
But it's good food.
Well, slow food is the best food, I think.
It is. It definitely tastes the best. But, you know, that's one goal, is to eventually, you know, get some of these populations back on the reservation, get some bulb banks and bulb beds going. So one day we can actually start, you know, having these as a food item up at the Table Bluff Reservation.
Yeah, that would be great. Well, one of the things I was thinking of when I was kind of looking at the Table Bluff Rancheria up there and seeing what there was is not only were a lot of fodder for animals imported, but actual toxic plants. Poison hemlock, it's in the family with a lot of plants that have been used traditionally as medicines and foods for Indian people. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, when you're trying to reintroduce plants and reintroduce Indian people to some of these historically edible or medicinal plants, you've got this other one in the mix.
Yes. Poison hemlock's been one of our biggest weeds out on the reservation. It's in the carrot family. So, you know, angelica was a plant that was sacred and used as food and medicine by the Wiat people. So, yeah, it does pose a problem. And we're, you know, have a couple restoration projects right now that are targeting the western hemlock and, you know, trying to eradicate it. It's a lot of work, you know, a lot of repeated mowing, and we're trying a sheet mulching, and we're also planting shrubs in some areas to eventually try to exclude it by shading. So
going after it.
Yeah, you know, it's with invasive species control, you kind of have to have adaptive management where you try everything in the bag. You know, we're not trying herbicides just because the tribe is against herbicide use, but trying pretty much everything else.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's good. Well, one of the things that's kind of interrelated with food is the basket making, because baskets, you know, were used as burden baskets. They were used for cooking baskets. So it's important to maintain those plants in terms of bringing back some of that food culture as well.
Yeah, it is. And hazelnut's kind of the big one that, you know, is the all-star that was both, you know, a critical basketry plant, but also a food plant, and one that's become harder and harder material to come by if you talk to local basket weavers. And so part of my job is helping to protect significant gathering sites for plants like hazelnut or woodwardia or maidenhair fern, so that the tribe can, you know, have these resources to continue to practice this, you know, beautiful art, basketry.
So with the hazelnut, what has been the thing that has made that disappear? Is it not culturing it?
I think it's, you know, not culturing it, and just conversion to pasture land seems to be a real issue with a lot of its habitat around Humboldt Bay. And forest encroachment, you can go into a young Sitka spruce forest on Table Bluff and see skeleton hazelnuts and huge manzanitas that, you know, just couldn't handle the shade and blinked out.
Yeah.
So kind of all of the above. And just there's kind of a lack of a lot of accessible public land for the Wiats. There is a lot of land in dune habitats that's public, but, you know, it's quite a ways east to get to Forest Service lands. And so a lot of these coastal prairies, you know, are all held up by ranch families and whatnot.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So access is a real issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it seems like the dune areas, I mean, it's a totally different environment. Doesn't seem like there's a lot of nutrients in the soil there.
Yeah. And I mean, the dunes certainly have a plethora of cultural use plants, especially huckleberry. But, you know, hazelnut doesn't grow out in the dunes. Indian potatoes do in certain places, but you don't get woodwardia fern or maidenhair fern out in the dunes too much.
What sorts of things are you planning for the future now to try to restore some of these lands?
One project we're working on is a western lily propagation and restoration project. So the western lily is a federally endangered plant. It's a beautiful red-flowered lily that grows on the coast from Coos Bay, Oregon, south to Table Bluff in scattered populations. And, you know, some people hypothesize that it was tended by the Wiat, and, you know, most of the true lilium bulbs were eaten by regional tribes. And so we've been able to collect seed from this and had some luck, you know, germinating some this year. That, you know, they grow very slow, and so it's going to be a multi-year project. We're also looking at moisture availability in our wetland just to see if it's even suitable for western lily. And so we have baseline data from the Table Bluff Ecological Reserve that local botanist Dave Imper worked on for his career. And so we kind of know what the western lily wants in a similar location that's just a couple miles down the road. And so we're going to hopefully be able to support those similar conditions at our wetland.
Great. If people wanted to get involved, if they want to help with the project, is there any opportunity for volunteers?
From time to time, there is. You know, you can contact the Natural Resource Department. In August, we have our annual Wiat Days event, which is a fun festival to come out and get to see part of Wiat culture. You know, other than that, just kind of when folks call and ask, we've got some students that are going to be volunteering with us here in a couple weeks. That's really nice. It helps with a lot of the weed control and stuff.
I'm even thinking about, because I got some seeds for some of the bulbs. Mm-hmm. I mean, like right in my own yard, I might just plant some of these and see what I can make happen. And maybe I can propagate some things.
Yeah, it's a great idea. I mean, these bulbs, they sort of propagate themselves if you put them in the right spot. And, you know, they do really well in planter beds. And then you kind of have them contained and you can go in and do little harvests and scatter the bulbs. And, you know, within a couple of years, hopefully you have your own little Indian potato
bank. I might have like a little thimbleful of potatoes that I might be able to cook up.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, Adam. I really appreciated talking with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy spring, everyone.
This program was supported in part by the Northwest California Tribal Communities Extension Program, a USDA-funded project through the University of California Cooperative Extension of Humboldt and Del Norte counties.